Arizona's wildfire season is apparently over, and we didn't have a catastrophic fire. But what should we be doing to make that a more common occurrence?
There's good evidence that fire seasons are extending, certainly over what they were 50 years ago. But that also expands the opportunity for us to intervene in useful ways.
I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, another blow to rural healthcare in Arizona as a hospital in Douglas shuts its doors. Google Fiber is one step closer to being available in Tempe. And are you ready for some football? A recent study calls out Cardinals fans as bandwagon jumpers. But is it just a matter of where we live?
Potential fans have other options, and you don't get the same intensity in Arizona as you do in Pittsburgh or Chicago or Boston.
Plus, what is working the night shift do to the human brain? That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody. The excessive heat warning still in effect for the Valley. That's through today and then picks up again tomorrow. Our record high for today is 116. No danger of that, but we should reach a high of 112. Currently mostly sunny skies and 109 degrees. Local and regional leaders with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs were in Phoenix today with an update on how the medical center is faring after facing allegations last year of extended patient wait times. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, they were cautiously optimistic.
Interim Phoenix VA Director Glenn Grippen says much of the progress the medical center has made is in staffing. Grippen says there are 750 open positions right now. He estimated about half of them are from turnover and the other half are new. Grippen says he was also pleased with some new pay increases coming through for hospital staff. He added while nursing pay is becoming competitive with the community, physician and senior executive pay is still lagging. He admitted improving wait times at the facility was still a challenge, though, but he says the picture isn't quite as bad as it seems, as the medical center is anticipating about 950,000 outpatient visits in fiscal year 2015. That's almost 150,000 more than 2013.
You know the demand was here that we weren't meeting. So certainly we're trying to meet that demand, and we're still not there yet, but we are improving.
Wait times for settling VA benefit claims are down. VA Regional Office Director Dwayne Honeycutt said the average claim last year took about 145 days to resolve. This year it's around 115. Honeycutt credited mandatory overtime, but he adds claims are now coming in more complete than they had in the past.
Literally 57% of the claims we get in the Phoenix Regional Office are fully developed. So that allows us to save some time with that it usually takes going out to try to get evidence.
Honeycutt says much of that progress can be credited to local efforts from veteran service organizations working with vets to prepare their claims. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The availability of health care in rural Arizona has long been a concern, and that's been ratcheted up in the past few days with the closure of the Cochise Regional Hospital in Douglas. That's thanks to the loss of Medicare funding in July. Ken Alltucker covers health care for the Arizona Republic. And Ken, one of the concerns from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services with the Cochise Regional Hospital had to do with patient safety. So to me, it seems ironic that patient safety could be further compromised now with the closing of the hospital. What can patients in the Douglas area do now?
There have been over 50 hospital closings in rural parts of the country, I think since 2010. So this is an issue that certainly is more broad than Arizona. In this particular case, there is a nearby hospital about 20, 25 miles away in Bisbee. And what they'll do is expand their clinic in Douglas. And what they say is they'll be able to take up a lot of the patients who are there. And for the more critical cases that require, like trauma cases, you think of a car accident or something like that, those cases would be airlifted to a Tucson hospital where they have that type of specialized care that a more advanced case would need.
Ken, there's no question the state of Arizona has a doctor shortage. How much worse is that in rural Arizona?
It's pretty extreme for a lot of cases. What we see is a primary care shortage in general. These are the family doctors, the people who take care of your day-to-day needs, and those who need specialty care generally gravitate toward more urban areas because the specialists don't necessarily have a population base in rural Arizona or any rural area to kind of sustain their practice. It certainly is a big shortage in Arizona, and what we're seeing is a lot of what folks call sometimes physician extenders, like physician assistants or nurse practitioners who typically operate under an MD or a DO. They provide the day-to-day care for a lot of people in these communities.
When it comes to the suit that's continuing over Medicaid expansion in Arizona, when we consider some of the requests that the Ducey administration made related to Medicaid earlier this week, if there are changes to what has occurred with the Medicaid expansion in the state, would that affect rural Arizona disproportionately compared to the rest of Arizona?
It potentially could, because in general, some of these rural communities, you have a a higher percentage of people there who are on Medicaid, which is sometimes counterintuitive. But the big challenge, I think, with the Ducey administration is getting the Obama administration to sign off on these changes. Some of the cost-sharing reforms that the Ducey administration has proposed. But if they do go into effect, potentially you could see communities that have a higher percentage of Medicaid people, they will certainly see a bigger effect there, the healthcare providers, the hospitals, the doctors.
Ken Altucker covers healthcare for the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Ken, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Fighting wildfires is a dangerous and difficult job, but researchers say those of us in other lines of work could learn some things from firefighters about dealing with unpredictable and chaotic situations in our own offices. Kathleen Sutcliffe is a professor in the schools of business and medicine at Johns Hopkins University and co-author of a paper on this subject, which was published in the Journal of Contingencies and Crisis Management.
When you look at the literature on business disasters, like many wildfires, they often start out small, with small little problems that managers or frontline people notice, but they don't really worry about too much. Or sometimes they notice it, but then they kind of just wish it away. And so I think that what our study says is that, by dynamically blending the actions of supervisors and frontline staff, that organizations, teams, groups can continuously adjust to create a more coherent understanding of what they're facing and can adjust their response in response to what they see.
Is that psychologically difficult to do? Because, a firefighter, they make decisions that could potentially be life-saving or not. When you're in a business environment, most often it's not a life or death situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And, when I talk to firefighters or I talk to other people who are in dynamic, high-risk, high-hazard kinds of industries, what they say to me is that naturally they're concerned about their life, but, they're also doing a job. And when you're doing a job, you can kind of get into a routine. And they may be more alert to their context and what's happening, but they also have to be careful not to normalize away particular details that signify that things have changed. So while they may be a little bit more alert, I guess I would argue that people in all range of different kinds of occupations, whether it's high hazard or not, oftentimes can get into routines, and then we take things for granted and we overlook signals. And when we're, rushed or we have performance and production pressures, that we sometimes kind of wish things away and ignore it at our peril.
So is the takeaway for businesses then that the important things are to pay attention to details, don't overlook things, even if they seem insignificant at the time, and when problems come up, deal with them as opposed to just hoping that they'll go away?
Well, I think the key message that comes from this work is that by organizing in a particular way, and as we said, by creating mechanisms that help people on the front line hang on to details, and creating opportunities for supervisors and people who are at a different level in the organization to interact with those people on the front line consistently, that you contextualize their engagement, that's how we think about it, that you're able to create opportunities for figuring out what's the story now and now what. So it's not just telling people to be alert. It's also creating mechanisms to help them do that.
Do you think that firefighters should be out there giving seminars and talking to other business folks about how they do what they do and how business folks can maybe do their jobs a little better and learn from what firefighters already know?
I think that we should be learning always from people who are outside our discipline or outside our industry or our context. I've always been impressed with people in the firefighting community that they really want to learn. They're constantly retooling and retraining, and I think they do have a lot of lessons to share with other people in other organizations and industries.
Kathleen Sutcliffe is a professor in the Schools of Business and Medicine at Johns Hopkins University and co-author of a paper which was published in the Journal of Contingencies and Crisis Management.
Arizona has been hit by catastrophic wildfires in recent years, but this has been an extremely mild season so far in the state. And with recent rain, there's no reason to think a major fire is around the corner. But how we prepare for and fight fires has changed over the decades. Fire historian Steve Pine has done extensive research on that, and we connected with him to learn more. Steve, what do you make of this current mild fire season?
We've got a paradoxical situation in the country, which is we have too much bad fire, but not enough good fire. And burned area alone doesn't record that. So we have this odd situation where we're told it's terrible, we're having so many millions of burned acres, fires are out of control, mega fires are coming, et cetera, at the same time told, wow, we really need to do a lot more burning of our own. And it's not that hard to understand, but they tend to get conflated together in unhelpful ways. So the problem is, you know, we did have that nice spring. We got a break. But, you know, that could have been an opportunity to go in and do some deliberate burning. Mm. In other words, prescribed fire. And that's sort of the larger issue with climate change and fire. Fire seasons, there's good evidence that fire seasons are extending, certainly over what they were 50 years ago. But that also expands the opportunity for us to intervene in useful ways. So, yeah, I think what I find really interesting about the Western scene in particular is the way people are trying to find a way to thread those two problems.
It sounds like what you're saying is that if you actually get a break with a season, then we should take advantage of that, but we tend not to do that. Do you think that is an issue where the philosophies aren't meshing, or people just don't really know what they should do when it comes to true planning and taking advantage of this?
Yeah, well, part of it's philosophy. I mean, nobody wants to pay for fire. We've not wanted to pay for fire for over a century now. And the way to get around that is to pay for emergencies, that is, wildfire. So it's not unlike a healthcare system where there seems to be plenty of money for emergency responses, but not much to just do the basics for general community health. So we have that issue. The other issue is that it's proved really difficult in the West to decide what the appropriate alternative strategy is. You know, 50 years ago, we began trying to change from a suppression policy, and parts of the country made it, particularly in Florida, where they will burn 2.5 to 3 million acres a year by prescribed fire.
Mm.
This is just Florida.
Yeah.
And they would like to burn more. So they were able to make it. The West, we can't. And partly because of land use. We're still fighting over what we want those public lands to be, and we can't agree. And so that polarized and political scene prevents us from dealing with fire. Fire gets hijacked for some other issue.
When people hear about prescribed burns and controlled burns, what are the clear, obvious benefits of doing that if it's done in a way that makes sense?
Part of it is ecological, part of it economic, part of it sort of public safety. If you do it right, then you are putting the kinds of fire on the ground that this system is ecologically adapted to. So it does little damage to the ecosystem, which translates into less damage to watershed, wildlife, and so forth.
conversely, it promotes, it enhances the integrity and stability of these systems. It also means that you are reducing the amount of combustibles on the land in a scaled way, so that prevents fires from blowing up on you.
When we have had those seasons, often with the catastrophic wildfires, it seems to make most of us shake our heads and think, well, why couldn't there have been something, as opposed to hearing, well, there isn't the budget to fight the fires? Well, it just seems like a logical maneuver to try to move more in that direction.
It would seem logical, but then you're having to spend money when there doesn't seem to be an urgent need for it. I mean, the largest experiment now in the country on trying to deal on a landscape scale with rehabilitating environment is the Four Forests Restoration Initiative in northern Arizona. They're several years behind schedule. They're now down to maybe 30,000 acres a year, treating with thinning and prescribed fire. And you say, okay, even if they got that, in 10 years they would have 300,000 acres treated. Well, the Wallo fire burned 538,000 in 2 weeks. It's not even money. It's political capital. It's social capital. It's just not going to happen soon enough.
Arizona State University professor and fire historian Steve Pine. Coming up on the show, understanding the complexity and reality of embedded war photography.
You know, there's this idea of journalistic detachment, but when you're standing next to somebody and you're getting shot at the same time they are, you're there. You're intrinsically present.
That's ahead on the show. Good afternoon. In Valley traffic at this hour, accidents on the 51 southbound at Thomas Road. There's also a collision 202 westbound the Red Mountain Freeway at the 24th Street off-ramp. And the HOV lane is blocked on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at Southern. Well, we're in the midst of an excessive heat warning today until 8 o'clock tonight, and then it resets tomorrow morning at 11 and runs again until 8. We're expecting to reach a high of 112. Our record high for today is 116. Currently with relative humidity at 12%, it's 109 degrees at 221.
KJZZ is supported by The Persian Room, health-conscious Persian cuisine for lunch and dinner, plus catering for your special occasions and business events. The Persian Room on Scottsdale Road, one light north of Bell, 480-614-1414.
If you've ever worked night shifts, then you'll know what the impact it has on body and soul. But a huge number of people do regularly work nights. In the UK, for instance, more than 10% of the workforce does shift work. So is it just a question of feeling more tired than usual, or are there serious risks involved in working at night? BBC presenter Sarah Montague, who regularly gets up at 3 in the morning, has been investigating.
It is just before 3:30, which means it's time to get up.
Everyone knows how rotten you can feel on little sleep. But we're only just beginning to understand the damage that it can do to your body, particularly when you sleep at the wrong time. Professor Russell Foster from Oxford University is one of Britain's leading sleep experts.
The assumption has always been that you adapt to the night shift. You know, the body clock will map on to the demands of working at night. And the really extraordinary findings across a whole range of different studies is that you don't adapt. And these sorts of empirical studies are beginning to explain why, for example, long-term night shift work gives rise to diabetes 2, coronary heart disease, and indeed cancer.
According to Russell Foster, the 24-hour pattern is so ingrained in our DNA that even our ability to reason during the night is severely impaired.
One's cognitive performance is down. In fact, at 4 o'clock in the morning, our ability to process information is similar to the effect of the amount of alcohol that would make us legally drunk, as bad as if we'd had a few whiskies or beers.
So forgive me for interrupting. 4 a.m.,
yeah.
Your ability to think is as if you were drunk.
It's as impaired, yes.
Deserted BBC centre.
4 a.m. is when we presenters arrive at work, and it's certainly not as much fun as being drunk. But one of the challenges is trying to get your brain to think straight. That's when colleagues, even grumpy ones, can come in useful.
Speak of the devil.
Morning.
How was your sleep?
Awful, since you asked. You wake up about 2 o'clock these days.
The problem is we've evolved over millions of years to sleep at night. Our sleep-wake cycle is controlled by a few thousand cells in our brain. Professor Michael Hastings from Cambridge University was the first to film them. He engineered a gene in the body clock of a mouse so that it lights up like a firefly when the genes are active.
That is, the body clock of a mouse, the light disappears, turns on, disappears, turns on. So, daytime, nighttime, daytime, nighttime.
How extraordinary.
It's fantastic engineering.
It's a graphic illustration of how we are hardwired to sleep at night.
All of our organs are running to this pre-programmed genetic pattern to make them do certain things at one time of day and different things at another time of day.
It's what may explain the high levels of obesity in those working at night. Professor Linda Morgan from the University of Surrey studies the way we metabolise food differently in the day and the night. So I invited her into my kitchen.
Now, Professor Morgan, I hurtle in here at 3:30 in the morning. If there is a triple chocolate muffin on the side, I can't help it. I think, oh, that'll come in handy in an hour or so's time.
That's a no-no, I'm afraid. That fat and that sugar will hang around in your bloodstream for a lot longer than it would do if you'd eaten that same muffin in the daytime.
Our organs just don't work properly at night. And recent research showed the brains of workers who'd done 10 years of night shifts had aged by an extra 6.5 years. So to a question I've been dreading asking, one for Professor Foster.
So are we able to say yet whether somebody who does night shifts lives a shorter life than somebody who doesn't?
Estimates have been made that you have significantly shortened lifespan as a result of night shift.
That's the BBC's Sarah Montague. Reporters who were embedded with American military units chronicle the activities of those groups and the soldiers within them. Embedded photographers have a similar job, one that Robert Cunningham took up as he spent time with 40 different units in Afghanistan. The Valley-based Cunningham took 55,000 photographs, some of which ended up in the book Afghanistan on the Bounce. Robert, when you take photos of people in a war zone, how do you gain their trust to begin with?
You know, first and foremost, the primary thing is being with them and being present both, you know, emotionally, physically, and otherwise. You know, there's this idea of journalistic detachment, but when you're standing next to somebody and you're getting shot at the same time they are, or you're, you know, they're holding, you know, your camera while they're holding their buddies that are hurt or otherwise, it's, you're there. You're intrinsically present. So that's the first step. But then there does have to be some back and forth conversations you have to have with people. You have to be able to be just as open with them as you want them to be with you, to where they can start understanding, is this the kind of person I want to be around? Is this the kind of person we want to have here? And there is always a battle. Every new unit I got with, every new group I was with, that rebooted. It's not just like, hey, that guy said I'm good. It's trying to work it up every time you get there.
I don't know how much you knew going in. I mean, obviously, we all have some knowledge of what's going on overseas. But once you get there and once you were embedded there, what did you learn that maybe just a basic fact you didn't know, or something that really surprised you?
You know, we all go into situations with preconceived notions. We go, what, you know, we had seen in the media, what we'd read, you know. I always had these ideas, and I knew that something wasn't right, because I sat with soldiers and service members, and they would watch the news with me, and they say it's not what it is. So I knew that there was something not right, but all those preconceived notions I had, just about every single one of them had to go out the window within seconds of arriving in Afghanistan. When you step there and you look there and you realize the world you're in, you realize the difference of on base versus off base. You realize the differences between the little bases and the big base. The first major takeaway I had was, when somebody says they're in the military, you need to kind of go and down a little bit further and say, okay, what do you do in the military? What's your job like? Because there's people who never leave the wire. There's people who are always outside the wire. There's all kinds of different jobs and placements that people go through. And, you know, one of the first things that got me was, you hear in the media talk a lot about getting women into combat roles. And there's this idea that most of us have it, that women aren't outside the wire. But, you know, on almost every patrol I went on, we had females with us, or we interacted with females that were soldiers that were working with us. the idea that they're not present, they're not out there, that was one of the big notions that I looked at and just is just patently false.
What is it like to take a photo of someone who may not survive, who this may be the last photo anyone ever sees?
You know, that was a realization I had to deal with very early on, unfortunately, in my first trip over there out of the three that I've done so far. It was one of those mentalities that with my camera, I could capture something that would be snatched away with a bullet. Is a terrifying thing, and it's a huge responsibility, in my opinion. And, you know, unfortunately, there was times we lost people that I hadn't gotten photographs of that I didn't. But then, you know, those times when you have something that you can hold on to and grasp, there is this, it's a very large part of what I do over there. In one of the responsibilities in my head was the realization that you're there for them to tell their story, to show what they are and going through. And God forbid if something happens and we lose them, that may be the last thing you can show their family. That may be the last thing that their family gets to hold on to.
How are you feeling after having taken photos, been involved as an embedded photographer? I mean, have you felt the impacts yourself?
Absolutely. I'm night and day different than who I was, you know, in July of 2011. You know, in July of 2011, as I was getting ready to go, you know, I have to admit there were some selfish reasons as why I wanted to. I had never served in the military, and you know, I felt an inner need to go, and there was a lot of selfish reasons as to why I went in the first time. But then very quickly on, I sat with a soldier, and one of the soldiers talked to me, and as we were leaving, he said, thank you. And I looked at him and said, why? And he said, you make us feel important. And, you know, I couldn't sleep that night. I told him, I said, you are important, whether people make you feel that way or not. And, you know, it was a slap to my face to realize why I needed to be there and what the real purpose for being there was.
Robert Cunningham, he's the photographer behind the book Afghanistan on the Bounce. Robert, thank you so much for the time.
It was my privilege. Thanks for having me.
Google Fiber is one step closer to landing in the city of Tempe and bringing faster internet service to the community. The city council's unanimous vote gives Google the access it requires to get the project going from an infrastructure standpoint. There's more to be done to make Google Fiber a reality here, but excitement has definitely been generated. Steven Zylstra is president and CEO of the AZ Tech Council. He says it's a big deal for a number of reasons.
First of all, I was just in Kansas City and talking to the folks there that run an equivalent organization to the Arizona Tech Council, and they said that when Google Fiber was installed in Kansas City that there was a precipitous jump in entrepreneurial activity. Now that there was more capability, things that weren't possible before were now possible, and it spawned a lot of creativity and innovation in the community.
Does the entire community stand to benefit then, Stephen, when you say that? Is this an idea that people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, will eventually see the benefits from it?
Well, I think so, because these new tools and technologies that entrepreneurs then develop are then going to be accessible and usable by people in general in the community. So I think whether it's business or residential users, they're going to have more capability, and that's going to lead to more innovation.
How significant is it to have the Google name on it? It seems like everyone sort of wants to do business with Google. Does that also have a benefit in and of itself?
Yeah, it's a brand name. It's sort of like when Apple came to town. It's a big deal. I think in many ways it suggests that the community's coming to its own. And, you know, the big players in the tech community globally are now focusing on our region. And it's going to give us greater capability to do some really cool things.
When this news came out, Cox seemed to be not that thrilled with this idea. Is this, in fact, a new service? Do you expect Google service to be different from what some areas of the Valley were already getting from other companies?
Not really. I think that you may recall when it was even announced over a year ago that Google Fiber might be coming to the Valley, that not too long after that, both CenturyLink and Cox announced 1 gig service. And from what I understand, the cities and towns that are participating, such as Tempe, Scottsdale, and Phoenix, have said point blank that it's going to be a level playing field, that Google's not getting anything more than they are. And for consumers, competition is a good thing.
What do you think this does for the Valley and Tempe specifically as far as making it not just an attractive place to do business, but an attractive place to live? Is this one of those things that when a city like Phoenix is trying to compete with other markets, this is a real plus?
Absolutely. As you know, the current generation is very interested in having the cool factor associated with a lot of things, where they live. They want that urban environment. They want the cool restaurants. And this Google Fiber has cachet, and it just means that Arizona and those cities in particular will have, you know, that brand name associated with it, which is considered very cool.
Stephen Zylstra is president and CEO of the AZ Tech Council. We've been talking about Tempe getting one step closer to getting Google Fiber in the community. Stephen, thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Coming up on the show, hikers look for direction from piles of rock.
This is a way to go. This is a way to avoid. This is a way to appease a deity. This is the way to honor the dead.
We'll stray from the path just ahead on the show. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Goldstein. This is the show on 91.5. We're in the midst of an excessive heat warning around the valley, looking for a high temperature of 112. Excessive heat warning in effect again tomorrow from 11 a.m. until 8 p.m. We're also expecting a high of 112 then. Currently, relative humidity is at 12%. It's mostly clear and 109 degrees. Meanwhile, if you're on the valley roadways, accidents to watch out for: 51 southbound at Thomas, the 202 westbound at 24th Street, and the 101 southbound in the East Valley. A collision at Southern is blocking the shoulder. It's 235.
KJZZ is supported by Stinson Leonard Street. With nearly 500 attorneys providing transactional and litigation legal services from 14 offices across the country, online at stinsonleonard.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Yesterday, President Obama outlined his plans to reduce emissions and reliance on carbon energy over the next 15 years. The plan will rely less on Congress and more on federal regulatory authority. This means that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, will become a much more powerful agency over the next decade. But how effective is the EPA at enforcing existing laws and enforcing them fairly? The EPA Office of Civil Rights is charged with correcting cases of discrimination against minorities who bear the brunt of industrial pollution's effects in many places, and it can withhold funds from states and localities that are found liable.
But a new investigation from the Center for Public Integrity finds that the agency's Office of Civil Rights rarely takes action under its Title VI authority, despite hundreds of complaints from across the country. Kristen Lombardi, senior reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, has found that the office has treated hundreds of cases with a disturbing lack of urgency, so much so that some plaintiffs have just given up on it.
The Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. So EPA was created in 1970, and soon after that, it did implement Title VI regulations. But it didn't accept or process complaints until 1993, and that's when the modern sort of Office of Civil Rights, as we know it, processing and adjudicating civil rights claims, sort of came into being. So there were 20 years of regulations, but the first complaint alleging environmental discrimination wasn't accepted by EPA until 1993.
And what form does this discrimination take, in the sense that remedies are being improperly applied or unequally applied to certain groups versus other groups, or that facilities are being created with this inequality in mind?
For the majority of complaints that we saw, we examined 15 years worth of complaints and the agency's response to those complaints. The majority dealt with permitting decisions. They were citing, you know, this location is discriminatory or will have a discriminatory effect. And sometimes it was pollution limits, you know, we're receiving the bulk of the pollution as well.
Based on your investigation, is the EPA a good place to take a complaint if you have, as a protected community, a claim of civil rights discrimination?
Not at all. Like I said, we looked at 15 years worth of complaints in the agency's response, and it's pretty much a pattern of denial, delay, and dismissal. 9 out of 10 times communities, their claims are rejected outright without investigation, or they're dismissed upon investigation. There was only one time that the agency found a preliminary finding of a Title VI violation, meaning that the decision that they were investigating did have a discriminatory effect, but it was never formalized because there was a negotiated settlement that came out of that case. So, you know, we talked to dozens of advocates and residents and lawyers who handle these cases, and they say, first of all, it's an underutilized legal tool that the agency has to actually combat environmental injustice. But it's almost laughable, the record, you know. And so we don't even advise our communities to take this path. And a lot of communities feel like, you know, they're the typical environmental justice community, but they have little recourse if they choose to go the Title VI route.
What could possibly be the rationale for over 15 years having virtually no claim come to any fruition on behalf of a citizen complainant?
Well, that's, you know, that's the really interesting question. And we actually interviewed quite a few former and current EPA officials, either who worked in the office and were actually investigating these complaints, or they worked closely with the office. And everybody says the same thing. The agency, over the years, just doesn't know how to handle these cases. They don't know what environmental discrimination looks like.
What communities do you recall in your investigation that are particularly egregious or mystifying?
Well, the story that we came out with looks at a neighborhood in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, called University Place Subdivision. It's predominantly African American, a neighborhood of pretty much single-family residences, some apartment buildings. And since 1960, there has been a city sewage plant right next to that neighborhood. When it first began operating, it was barely visible to neighborhoods. But over the decades, it's been expanded and sort of transformed into an industrial complex. And it, there's nothing but a two-lane street separating the sewage plant from the neighborhood. Since 2009, the neighborhood, residents in the neighborhood have filed 5 complaints with the EPA's Office of Civil Rights, saying the city has violated our civil rights by not just citing the plant there, but operating it in such a way that we are victim to invasions of sewer flies, which are well documented in state records, bad odors, I mean, human waste odors, and water pollutions, incessant water pollutions. This particular plant was a chronic violator of the Clean Water Act. And so it's not just that the city cited this plant here, but it's been operating this plant in a way in which we're experiencing the adverse effects. And we thought, wow, this is a pretty strong case, and at least the EPA should investigate. But 4 of those 5 complaints were dismissed outright for technical reasons, really, on procedural grounds, some of which the EPA could waive if it wanted to.
And has anything been done?
Well, I mean, residents call the Office of Civil Rights the do-nothing office. You know, they're very adamant about the fact that it's a sort of an exercise in futility, filing a complaint with the EPA's Civil Rights Office. What they did was team up with a local environmental group. They did file a civil lawsuit against the city, which, you know, got stuck in court, 10 years worth of litigation that ended in a ruling saying they were not entitled to personal injury damages. So that went nowhere. But they did team up with a local environmental group, and they sued under the Clean Water Act over those water pollution violations, those permit violations. And they ended up forcing the city to move some. The city has agreed to move some of the residents, only 41 households, and to create a buffer zone, a 300-foot buffer zone around this facility. Now, residents would say that doesn't take away the fact that our civil rights were violated because we've lost our community. We have had to move.
This is one of how many claims you investigated?
Almost 300, 265.
EPA's an explanation for all this?
The EPA did not deny our numbers. We spoke with the current Office of Civil Rights Director, Velveeta Golightly Howell. She did acknowledge problems processing the complaints, and she said, you know, we can't focus on the past. The past is over. There's nothing we can do about it, but we can focus on the present and the future, and we are.
Kristen Lombardi is senior reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Don.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. One of the most popular and spectacular natural sites in the state is the geologic phenomenon known as the Wave near the Utah-Arizona border. If you've never seen it, it looks sort of like striped layers of cinnamon and sugar, curved and swirled around into a Dr. Seuss-like prehistoric landscape. In order to visit it, you have to obtain a permit from the Bureau of Land Management. And only about 10% of the 73,000 annual applicants get one. Now the BLM has suggested changes to the permitting process, and joining me to talk about that is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
So what exactly is the BLM proposing?
Well, right now only 20 people a day are given permits to visit the Wave. 10 of those permits are given through an online lottery, and then the other 10 are given by an in-person one, which means that you have to actually go to Kanab, Utah to participate in order to get a permit to visit the following day. Now, the BLM wants to get rid of the in-person lottery and instead have just an online lottery to get a permit 48 hours in advance. This is Dennis Godfrey with the BLM in Arizona.
It allows you to plan your trip a little bit better. If you're in the area and you're looking at many of the choices that are available, the North Rim of the Grand Canyon, Zion National Park, other areas in southern Utah, and you're in that area for the experience, you can plan now. 2 days from now, we have opportunity to go to the Wave. You would know that in advance.
Wow. So I imagine this change would make a big impact in Kanab, Utah, where people are going to be a part of the lottery for permits.
Exactly. There's some concern by folks in Kanab that because people head up there, stay in hotels, eat at restaurants, those sorts of things, that if the system changes to an online one, people might not spend as much time or money there. I talked about this with Ken Gotzenberg. He's the director of tourism for Kane County, Utah, where Kanab is.
Our concern is it eliminates all of the other people that would have come to apply for the lottery. Only the people that win the lottery would show up in Kanab. And currently, the odds are pretty steep against anybody winning the lottery. So all those that would have been, if you will, the losers would probably not come to Kanab.
How much do Kanab businesses rely on these kinds of tourists?
Well, Kanab's economy is primarily tourism. Our location right in the middle of 3 national parks and 5 national monuments and other great stuff accounts for 46% of our economy in our community. And a great deal of that, in addition to the regular tourists, would be people applying for the Wave lottery. And hopefully, if they're not getting it that day, they're striking out to do a national park or one of other backcountry adventures. I've been in lotteries where there's been over 200 people in the room applying for a permit, and again, only 10 are going to win that permit.
What would you say to someone who might make the argument that in some ways restructuring the permitting process in this way could make the Wave accessible to more people? So, for example, I live in Phoenix, and maybe I can't afford to come up to Kanab and stay for a few days and wait to see if I win the lottery, but I can apply online, and then if I get accepted, I can just drive up in a day and be there.
I imagine there's as many losers to the online lottery as there are winners. Still, the limit of people going to the Wave will still be 20. But the number applying will still be quite high. So you're applying from Phoenix. You're competing against people from Germany and China and France and around the world. It will not improve your odds in the least. Unless they raise the number of people that can actually visit the Wave, which isn't part of the consideration currently, then still the chances of getting a permit is going to be pretty astronomical.
Is there anything that you or the Office of Tourism would like to see happen as maybe some kind of a compromise between the current system and the proposed new system?
Well, a couple of things that have been talked about and not well listened to would be to raise the number of people that could visit the Wave. Another would be we've got dozens of well-qualified guides and outfitters in our area who have a special recreation permit to take guided tours to the Wave and other areas like that. And one of the suggestions I'd like to be considered is that if you wanted to go to the Wave, you would hire a guide. If the guide had an opening, you would automatically get a permit because now you're going with an authorized guide. That would be in addition to the 20 that's already being issued to other people. That would keep our economy alive, increase the number of people that go to the wave, plus provide a pretty good living to some of our local businessmen.
That's Ken Gotzenberg, the director of tourism for Kane County.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
When people go hiking these days, all kinds of gadgets can help guide their way. But historically, humans have used something a lot more low-tech, a pile of rocks. It's technically called a cairn, and it's marked trails for millennia. But as KJZZ's Stina Sieg explains, in recent years, these stones have become steeped in controversy.
Beth Dinette is searching for the perfect rocks. Smooth, flat, easy to stack, and with the right metaphysical energy for a cairn.
I don't know, they just give an overwhelming sense of peace and connecting with oneness.
She's crouched on the banks of Buddha Beach, just outside the New Age hub of Sedona. It's a popular swimming hole and considered a spiritual vortex. Dinette's cairn celebrates that energy and joins dozens of others left here.
And when someone else walks this path and they see these rocks, they know that, hey, someone else experienced maybe the same thing or had the same thought that I did when I was out here. So it's a unity.
Yes, I have knocked down a few. Sure.
That's Robin Martin, a senior lecturer at Northern Arizona University. She calls these cairns pointless reminders of human ego.
And somebody might think I'm kind of a crank, or at least curmudgeonly.
But for years, she's seen cairns go from being navigational tools to becoming a kind of backcountry fad, popping up like mushrooms. And Martin's irritation isn't just about aesthetics. Moving rocks alters the landscape, she says, causing erosion and evicting insects from their homes. They can also confuse hikers, leading them astray.
There are so many different ways to express yourself and to be out, you know, in these wilderness areas with your family or by yourself where you don't have to leave a reminder for somebody else to find that you were there.
She recently wrote as much in an essay featured on the website for the magazine, The High Country News. The online comments were immediate and blistering. Some readers agreed with Martin, but others wrote things like, go murder some kale.
Or get a life.
Or hashtag, is there a rock shortage?
I was completely blindsided by those.
But it didn't surprise author David B. Williams. He turned up similar passion while researching his 2012 book, Cairns, Messengers, and Stone. He says national parks in particular have been inundated by these towers of rock, from Maine to California to Hawaii.
They're everywhere.
And careless cairns go against the very nature of these stone columns, which Williams says have been used on every continent to convey various messages.
This is a way to go. This is a way to avoid. This is a way to appease a deity. This is the way to honor the dead.
It's been that way for thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years, Williams says, which is why, even though he's frustrated by many cairns, he also understands the human urge to construct them. Back at Buddha Beach, Beth Dinette is topping off her cairn with a white rock, sparkling with a bit of crystal. She says she gets the environmental argument, but feels her little pillar shouldn't be compared to graffiti or litter.
There's worse things in life that you could do to make you feel good than stack some rocks.
And so the fad continues, one stone at a time. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Sedona.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. It's been a busy afternoon on the Valley Roadway. Still a lot of accidents to tell you about. 51 southbound at Thomas, 202 westbound at 24th Street, I-17 northbound at 16th Street, and the 101 southbound at Southern. Excessive heat warning with us until 8 o'clock tonight. It's currently 109 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by APS Solutions for Business, helping small business owners by assessing energy use and making your business more energy efficient so you can manage your bottom line. Learn more at aps.com/betterbottomline.
Are you ready for some football? The NFL season is right around the corner, and following an 11-win season in 2014, some predict the Arizona Cardinals could be Super Bowl contenders this year. But are their fans as super as their team? A recent study says no. Even though the Cardinals have sold out every game for the past 9 seasons, KJZZ's Phil Latzman is here with an explanation. Phil, what's going on?
Now, wait, before you start throwing footballs at your radio, Steve, keep in mind I'm just the messenger here. This was a study carried out by the Goizueta Business School at Emory University in Atlanta, and it ranked Cardinals fans as, quote, most likely to jump on the bandwagon based on their team's success. Now, the author of the study, and the guy you should be throwing your footballs at, the radio at, is Michael Lewis. He's a PhD in marketing at the school, and here's how he explains the research.
You know, for this study, basically we end up looking at how fans in different markets respond based on how successful their teams are in terms of winning rates. We've done this across all sorts of leagues. In the NFL, we do find, and you know, it's interesting. It's actually, it ends up being a fairly consistent result that we do find that the Cardinals fans tend to really be, and we can, look, we can use whichever word you want. We can
careful
say
now.
Really,
careful now, right?
We can say these are really discerning, very critical fans that demand excellence of their team, or we can flip it and say these are fans that are only going to show up when the team's performing well.
So, and I have not been in the Valley very long, but I am from South Florida and do know that there are some fickle fans there. So I know what it's like. And you're in Atlanta, by the way, which isn't always known as a great sports town either. But the Arizona Cardinals fans that I've spoken to in response to this say, wait a second. We've sold out almost, I think, every game since moving to the new stadium, University of Phoenix Stadium in 2006. So how could it be that they are jumping on the bandwagon?
Well, and that is, there's kind of two sides to this. And the thing that probably is being overlooked by those fans is, it's not just, getting people in the stadium. Because, there's different ways to get people in the stadium, where the biggest one is essentially you cut prices. And so if you look at, go across markets, one of the things you'll find is that, the prices that are charged in places like Phoenix or in places like Jacksonville are really very low compared to some other markets. And I'll give you a non-Arizona example. Last year, the Jacksonville Jags actually, had a higher attendance rate than the Pittsburgh Steelers. And so, you can't just look at straight numbers. You've got to also look at things like, how much are people willing to spend to be in those stadiums?
So I guess the question is that every Arizona Cardinals fan wants to know right now as we head into the NFL season is, are they bad fans? Are according to you, do they need to be to improve their fandom?
Well, it's really tough to say that someone is a bad fan, right? Because, sports fans, they're tremendous consumers. Our study is really looking at kind of relative measures of this. And so is the intensity of the Arizona Cardinals fans, is that at the same level as, the Chicago Bears fans or, the Dallas Cowboy fans or the Pittsburgh Steelers fans? The numbers suggest not. I think the other thing that comes into play, which I find always fascinating, you mentioned that you were from South Florida, is that we, across all the sports we look at, we tend to see less intensity or less engagement of fans in the warm weather market. So it's almost like, when the sun shines more, sports fans have, or potential fans have other options, and you don't get the same intensity in Arizona as you do in Pittsburgh or Chicago or Boston.
That is Dr. Michael Lewis of the Goizueta Business School at Emory University in Atlanta. So bottom line, Steve, since you've lived here most of your life, I've spent the last 2 decades in Florida, much of it covering sports. Maybe the sunnier the weather, the shadier the fans.
Phil, I'm one of those loyal fans, win or lose, but what's wrong with following a winner, right? KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's The Show. Thanks for tuning in, and be with us tomorrow morning at 11 for KJZZ's Here and Now. We'll be talking with Arizona's Access Director Tom Betlock about changes in Medicaid. Also, editorial cartoonists can generate a lot of responses from newspaper readers, sometimes not real positive. We'll talk with the Arizona Republic's Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, Steve Benson. That's tomorrow morning at 11. The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is John Hoban. All Things Considered is up next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by the University of Arizona Cancer Center at Dignity Health St. Joseph's Hospital, bringing comprehensive cancer care to downtown Phoenix. Learn more at dignityhealth.org/UACC.